GX on Agriculture with Doug Falconer.
Good afternoon and welcome to GX on Agriculture. Coming up on today's program, grain markets were mixed this week. We'll hear from PI Financial Commodity Futures Advisor Adam Piccolo, who will talk about the fact that canola has been trading down while spring wheat futures have been trading up this week. The Saskatchewan Water Security Agency released the preliminary spring runoff outlook for 2023 on Wednesday. We'll hear from Water Security Agency spokesman Sean Osmar, who will tell us about not just some of the land around the area, but also some of the river systems in the Parkland region. The identification of African swine fever and wild boar in Greece highlights the Swine Health Information Center's monthly Global Swine Disease Surveillance Report. Executive Director Dr. Paul Sundberg will join us on today's program. And good soil makes good food is the theme of Sask Soils annual conference coming up in Regina next week. Mark Heimer from Minton is the chair of Sask Soils. He'll talk about some of the speakers that will be attending that conference in Regina. All of those stories and much more coming up on today's edition of GX on Agriculture. But first, it's time for the Agriculture Outlook with Precision Weather. And that's a presentation of Milligan Bio. Milligan Bio now offers BioMeal for your livestock, giving your animals more protein, more energy, and more of what they need. It's also brought to you by Sean Prahitka, your REMAX Blue Chip Ag Division Specialist. Welcome back to GX on Agriculture. Grain markets were mixed this week. PI Financial Commodity Futures Advisor Adam Piccolo says canola is down about $5 per metric ton, while spring wheat futures have risen about 15 cents a bushel.
Starting off on the canola front, the March contract is down approximately $5 a ton on the week. Currently on today, we are down about $2.50, sitting at $8.25 a ton. On the wheat side of things, Minneapolis wheat on the March contract increased approximately 15 cents a bushel. Today, we are actually up about 17 cents at about $9.34. So today, the story that I'm kind of looking at here is definitely on the wheat front. We're seeing a pretty big rally here in Chicago, up about 32 cents, and Kansas up about 34 cents here on the day. We did see some bullish numbers from the USDA report on Wednesday. We saw small changes to the U.S. and world stocks. Both were below the average estimates. Steady exports and use, definitely. The only maybe slight bearish side of the report was Australian production is up 3.8% month over month. But right now, it seems that traders are, again, kind of watching some of the weather in the U.S., and we might be having a bit of a short covering rally here today. However, what I'm going to be talking about with producers is to definitely be considering rallies like this is potential selling opportunities. Are we done here yet? Not sure, but I think it's something to definitely keep a close eye on.
He explains why the price of canola is dropping.
Canola has been really trading quite sideways here kind of for the month of February. We saw, again, a bit of a rally off the lows kind of back at the end of January when it dipped below $800 a ton. Now we're sitting at, again, about $825 here right now. It has definitely been kind of affected by some of the weather that's affecting soybeans and the meal and the oil. Today, one thing I always like to talk about with clients is how markets affect other markets. So with beans up 16 cents here today, soybean oil up $1.25 today, we might see canola go positive on the day because it is still, again, down a few dollars. So I always like to look at how markets are interconnected and help advise clients with their marketing.
Piccolo provides his outlook for next week and beyond.
Well, it'll be important to see if this rally in wheat is something that can be sustained. It has been, you know, again, still really trading sideways with the range, you know, of about 40 cents here. So Minneapolis now is at the top end of that range at around 9:30. Chicago is definitely starting to break out. And if we do see it above $8, that could definitely bring, you know, Minneapolis up with it.
Adam Piccolo is a commodity futures advisor with PI Financial in Winnipeg. It's time now for the Ag Review portion of our program, and that's a presentation of New Era Ag Technologies in Swan River.
GX94, Ag Review.
The 10% top-up to the federal government's carbon tax rebate for rural Canadians should be reevaluated. That's according to a Liberal MP from rural Nova Scotia. As part of debate in the House of Commons on Tuesday over a Conservative motion to cancel the federal price on carbon, Cody Blois told his colleagues he thinks the 10% rural supplement to the rebate should be reviewed to determine whether it's adequate to make up the difference in the amount paid by rural versus urban Canadians. Blois says he's also worried about the definition of rural might be too narrow. Officially named the Climate Action Incentive Payment, or CAPE, the tax-free payments are sent to residents of provinces where the federal carbon tax or fuel charge is applied: Ontario, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. Residents of Blois' home province of Nova Scotia, as well as Prince Edward Island and Newfoundland and Labrador, will receive their first CAPE checks in July of this year. The Canadian Agri-Food Trade Alliance, or CAFTA, who represent 90% of Canadian farmers, producers, food manufacturers, and agri-food businesses, strongly oppose Bill C-282, the act to amend the Department of Foreign Affairs Trade and Development Act when it comes to supply management. The bill, sponsored by a Bloc Québécois MP, would amend existing legislation to prevent Canada's trade minister from increasing tariff rate quotas and reducing over-quota tariffs for dairy, poultry, or eggs through international trade agreements. CAFTA says this legislation creates a dangerous precedent and diminishes Canada as a free trade partner. They say it contradicts established trade rules and severely constrains Canada's ability to negotiate the best free trade agreements for all sectors of the Canadian economy, agriculture and non-agriculture alike. The end result is a less ambitious free trade agenda and less commercially meaningful outcomes for Canada. There's a new potato king in Canada. Alberta surpassed Prince Edward Island last year, according to the latest numbers from Statistics Canada. Alberta grabbed the number one spot with 26.8 million hundredweight of potatoes, only 200,000 ahead of Prince Edward Island. Manitoba was the third largest potato province at 26.1 million hundredweight. Saskatchewan was well down the list in eighth place at 1.45 million hundredweight. However, Statistics Canada notes that its production numbers for Saskatchewan are to be used with caution. Potato production grew 1.5% on a national basis last year. Statistics Canada reports 122.9 million hundredweight of potatoes were harvested last year on just over 381,000 acres. As provinces and states across North America look to capitalize on the potential of the agri-processing industry, Alberta will build on the province's competitive advantages by launching a new tax credit program this spring. Budget 2023 will introduce the Alberta Agri-Processing Investment Tax Credit to provide a 12% non-refundable tax credit to support this growth and attract investments into Alberta's agri-processing industry. The incentive program is available to corporations making a capital investment of $10 million or more to build or expand agri-processing facilities in Alberta. Capital investments made on or after February 7th of this year may be considered in the calculation of a company's total tax credit. The Canadian company, ranked among the three biggest cheesemakers in the United States, is preparing to consolidate five of its cheese plants in that country down to two. Montreal-based Saputo has announced it has construction underway on a new $240 million cut-and-wrap cheese plant in the Milwaukee suburb of Franklin to be up and running at capacity by the third quarter of 2025. When the new plant is ready, Saputo said it expects to transfer other packaging operations there. To that end, the company said it plans to close its plant in South Dakota in the third quarter of next fiscal year and another Wisconsin plant at Green Bay in its 2025 quarter three. Also, another Saputo plant at Tulare, California, previously slated to be shut down, will now get $75 million in renovations to convert to string cheese packaging to be up and running at capacity by quarter three of 2025. After that, a Los Angeles area string cheese packaging plant at Southgate will be closed and its work transferred to the converted Tulare site. And G3 is renewing its support of the Canadian Agricultural Safety Association, or CASA. The company is committing $50,000 to CASA this year, maintaining G3's position as a top sponsor and safety champion of the Be Grain Safe program. CASA's Be Grain Safe program raises awareness of the risks of becoming trapped in grain, trains firefighters in rescue techniques, and makes available specialized grain rescue equipment to rural fire departments. Since Be Grain Safe's inception in 2016, G3 support has helped train hundreds of firefighters and provided dozens of sets of rescue equipment in farming communities in Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, and Quebec. Grain entrapment is a potentially deadly risk for farmers and others who work around large volumes of grain, and specialized training and equipment are needed to safely extract a victim. Just last year, a Manitoba farmer trapped in grain was rescued by local firefighters who had received Be Grain Safe training and equipment. And that's the AgriView portion of our program. Please stay tuned. GX on Agriculture will be back right after this. Welcome back to GX on Agriculture. I'm Doug Faulkner. It's mainly sunny and minus 6 degrees in the Yorkton-Melville region. I'll have your complete weather details coming up at 1 o'clock. The Saskatchewan Water Security Agency released the preliminary spring runoff outlook for 2023 on Wednesday as it prepares its initial spring runoff report for March of 2023. The information gathered was based on conditions as they were on February 1st. Water Security Agency spokesman Sean Osmar explains.
Yeah, so this is our preliminary report, like you said, and it's compiled using data from conditions that freeze up, so what it was like going into late fall, early spring, or early winter, as well as precipitation that's accumulated to this point. So what we'll be doing next is we'll be going out across the province doing some actual snowpack surveys. We'll have our people in the field actually measuring snow depth in about 100 different locations across the province. And that'll help fill out, the fuller report that we'll release in March. That'll have, more complete data and a more accurate picture. What it looks like right now, what our preliminary report looks like right now is we should be, a little bit below to near normal for much of the province. There's a few areas, of course, that are below normal and then a pocket mostly around the Maple Creek area that's well below normal.
The Parkland region of Saskatchewan is expected to have near-normal runoff this spring. Osmar then provides an update on expected water levels for the Qu'Appelle River system.
So as things look right now, the Qu'Appelle system does look good. Looks like we should expect to see, pretty normal levels of water levels through there into spring and summer. We're not expecting significant runoff at this point. Of course, with several weeks of winter left, we could still see more snow accumulations and additional precipitation, which would obviously change things. Further up the waters, the headwaters there, the alpine snowpack, it looks like we're in pretty good shape there. It looks to be pretty normal. And again, we'll have to wait and see how that develops come melt.
As for the Souris River Basin.
So Souris River, I mean, going into freeze-up report, they were a little bit drier than normal. But we saw some, late fall, early winter precipitation down that way, which does help. Overall, we expect to see, pretty normal amounts. We expect to see those major reservoirs down there be full from the runoff for, spring and summer operations.
Osmar also has the latest on the Quill Lakes, which have experienced some very high water levels in the past.
Again, it looks like we're going to be kind of a normal, as it stands right now, sort of a normal runoff expectation. Of course, we have to wait and see. Like last summer, last year, we had a slower melt. So the speed of the melt will also determine, to some extent, how much of this will run off, how much will stay with the soil. So we're watching to see how that will develop as well.
And he adds that they'll put out another report in about a month's time.
Early March, we'll have our full runoff report starting, and then we'll provide regular updates from that point forward as the melt develops.
Sean Osmar is a spokesman for the Saskatchewan Water Security Agency.
Livestock market conditions.
U.S. live cattle futures for April are trading at 164 even. That's up 37. June live cattle trading at 159.80, up 27. March feeder cattle trading at 186.52, down 30. April feeder cattle trading at 190.60, down 12. April lean hogs trading at 83.30, down 2. May lean hogs trading at 93.22, up 20. And that's the livestock market conditions. The identification of African swine fever in wild boar in Greece highlights the Swine Health Information Center's monthly Global Swine Disease Surveillance Report. Executive Director Dr. Paul Sundberg says Greece has had that disease before.
African swine fever hasn't been in Greece since 2020. And so this is the first time for multiple years that they found wild boar, again, two dead wild boar in Greece. And that was near the border of Bulgaria, North Macedonia. So the expectation is, and the reports are, that most probably is the movement of wild boar from those countries in the north down into Greece. And I think that's probably an illustration of the continued activity of ASF, especially in Eastern Europe, as well as another example is in South Korea. Wild boar continue to move. Wild boar continue to harbor the virus and serve as a reservoir of infection. And it's very difficult to control those animals because they are out in the wild. There is no... and there's no way to make sure that you've got every one of them. And so it's an extremely difficult thing. And that's probably the headline for the African swine fever movement for the last month or so. The wild boar continue to be active. They continue to be infected. They continue to be a nidus of infection. The same thing happened in South Korea. That wild boar were discovered in South Korea, the same issue. And so I think that's probably one of the things of emphasis for ASF at this time for this report.
He says Canada and the United States need to continue to be vigilant against African swine fever due to the large populations of wild boars in the two countries.
What we're trying to do is we're trying to learn the lessons that are often through the European experience with wild boar. As best we can determine, we in North America have about the same density of wild boar as in Europe. It's hard to compare the two directly because they do different measurements of boar density, But it looks like for our land mass, we have about the same spots of density as there are in Europe. And so our issue is learning those lessons of how they were able to or have been able to control it. One of the things, for example, is in Luxembourg. And in Luxembourg, there was an infection in wild boar. They successfully eliminated, were able to isolate the wild boar in the area and work their way in and eradicate those wild boar in the area of infection and successfully remove ASF from their population of wild boar. That's a big lesson to learn, and I think that's one of the implications for North America. USDA Wildlife Services has been working very hard on plans to implement the same type of situation in North America, in U.S., if that would happen here. The plan is to try to ring the infection, ring around the infection, and work your way in from the outside, meeting in the middle and eradicating all the boar as you go in. And so that has been successful in some places in Europe, and we're hopeful that that would be a successful plan. One of the things that our industry is doing in the U.S. is working with wildlife services, trying to encourage them to do field trials of the plan so we can see exactly how it could work and how successful it could be in elimination. There's a lot of planning that's been done, and we're cautiously optimistic, but we also know that given the European experience, if ASF gets into the wild boar population, the feral pig population in North America, it very well may be extremely difficult to take out.
And Dr. Sundberg had these final thoughts.
Well, I think that this is a North American issue. It is, there are wild pigs, there are feral pigs, wild boar in Canada, in the U.S., and in Mexico, and they don't respect borders, neither state, province, country borders. And so it's an issue that we all have to work on, we all have to be ready for, and I think it's one that all three countries recognize the importance of the quick response and importance of trying to control and eradicate any infected wild boars just as quickly as possible.
Dr. Paul Sundberg is the Executive Director of the Swine Health Information Center. Please stay tuned. GX on Agriculture will return in 30 seconds' time. Welcome back to GX on Agriculture. I'm Doug Falconer. Good soil makes good food is the theme of Sask Soil's annual conference coming up in Regina next week. Sask Soil is the descendant of the Saskatchewan Soil Conservation Association, which drew large numbers of producers for their events in the 1990s when direct seeding was being introduced on more farms. Mark Heimer from Minton, Saskatchewan, is the chair of Sask Soils. He says two of the featured speakers come from the United States.
David Montgomery and Ann Bilk from Washington have just written a book, What's Your Food Ate? And we're really excited to have them in. David Montgomery has been writing books for quite a few years now. His background, he is a soil, he's a geologist. So it gives him a really interesting perspective on agriculture. And the book that they wrote is basically an extension of the old adage that you are what you eat, and that what our food eats, whether that be livestock or whether that be plants, and how things are grown and how everything is handled, has a great effect on the nutrients that we find in our food. And I think it's a part of the reason that we are so excited to have them is because it really does a great job of linking agriculture and food and consumers and tying it all together. And we're really excited about having them.
Another speaker is Mark Schatzker, who has combined travel with his love of food. For example, steak.
Yes. That's his first book is steak, and I cannot cannot imagine a more perfect job than having to go all the way around the world and have people prepare steaks for you. It sounds like, I don't know how he talked himself into that, but it's a, it's a fantastic book. And just kind of playing on along the same theme, just going to different regions, having beef that's been raised and different genetics and different backgrounds fed differently in different regions, and seeing how that affects the flavor of the meat that the meat that he was eating. He's also written a few books since then, Dorito Effect, and his most recent one is called Cravings, and it's a very interesting topic because all of these books tie into the fact that the way that the food is raised matters. The way the food is grown, the grain is grown, the way the livestock are raised, it all has an effect, and it all plays into the not just the flavor but also the nutritional content of the food that we eat.
Heimer talks about some of the other speakers lined up for their conference.
A fellow from down in the States, his name is Dan Kittredge, and he's involved with the Bio-Nutrient Food Association. And he's one of the people that is trying to put data behind the things that everyone else is discussing when it comes to nutrient density. So his organization is doing a tremendous amount of testing when it comes to the nutrient content of food, going much deeper than is usually tested for. And he's working on a device to help consumers to be able to sort through different foods and recognize some higher and some lower quality or nutritional content in foods. As well, we will have a few of our board members, Derek Axton and Cody Straza, just speaking on kind of some more localized experience when it comes to not only producing food and the different things that they've been approaching as far as cover cropping and compost and the different ways to farm and raise livestock, as well as some of the things that they've been doing to try to get their products out to consumers. So we've tried to round it all off and make it something that ideally not just farmers that are interested in the way that they're doing things will find of great interest, but also consumers that are interested in the differences of the difference it makes on how food is raised.
He also talks about the streaming option for those who can't make it to Regina next Tuesday and Wednesday.
We use the Whova app, so people who do choose to go virtually are able to use that app. And yes, there will be chat rooms, and we're trying to get discussion groups, and they'll be able to ask questions while they're watch the presentations live, and also participate in the question and answer. It is the same format we used last year, and we were very happy with it and had really great reviews. So while we're hoping that as many people can attend in person, that's definitely an option.
More information on the Sask Soil Conference can be found at sasksoil.ca.
Commodities Update.
Canola futures are trading up in the nearby months this hour. March canola trading at $831.70, up $4 per metric ton. May canola trading at $824.40, up $1.20. March Minneapolis wheat trading at $9.29¾, up 12.5 cents. March Kansas City wheat trading at $9.06¼, up 27.25 cents. March Chicago wheat trading at $7.82½, up 25.25 cents. March corn trading at $6.78½, up 7¾ of a cent. March soybeans trading at $15.37 per bushel, up 17¾ of a cent. March oats trading at $3.77½, down 3.5 cents. And that's the commodities update. Welcome back to GX on Agriculture. Research conducted by the Prairie Swine Center shows a dramatic reduction in antibiotic usage on swine farms following raised without antibiotics production practices. Dr. Bernardo Predicala, a research scientist of engineering with the Prairie Swine Center, tells us what prompted their investigation.
So the study was aimed to investigate whether the RWA, or raised without antibiotic practices, are really impacting the antibiotic usage in those barns, as well as if they're really impacting the frequency of prevalence of antimicrobial resistance, as well as pathogens. There have been reports previously that were in those barns that adopted RWA practices, they observe an increased prevalence of pathogens in their barns after a few years within the program. And then we also want to quantify whether those practices are actually impacting what they're supposed to be, the reduction in antibiotic use.
He explains who was involved in the research.
So in this research, we were working with Dr. Darren Corver, a professor at the University of Saskatchewan, and we recruited two types of barns, so several barns. Of course, we recruited RWA barns as well as non-RWA barns, and then we collected data from those barns over 2.5 years. So we collected their records of usage of antibiotics as well as the treatments that they did in those barns and all those barns, as well as we collected samples every 3 to 6 months from each of those barns. And then we collected fecal samples, nasal swab samples on piglets as well as on sows. And then we collected manure samples as well as samples from the environment around the barn, and we sent them for analysis to determine the levels of pathogens in those samples as well as the levels of antimicrobial resistance genes that are present in those samples.
As for the key findings,
well, the key findings is in terms of the total antibiotic usage, as expected, there's of course a lower amount of antibiotics used in RWA barns. It's not zero, but it's much lower, as factor as much from 5 to 10 fold lower compared to non-RWA barns. On the other side, on the antimicrobial resistance genes, so we've seen that RWA barns have lower frequency of detecting those antimicrobial resistance genes. But on the side of prevalence of pathogens, we've seen a rise of some specific pathogens in the RWA barns. So we're presuming that it's because of we're reducing the amount of antibiotics in those barns, so giving rise to the prevalence or recurrence of these specific types of pathogens.
Predicala says a number of pathogens were found.
There are several types of pathogens from protobacteria and then Firmicus. We're just initial stage of looking at the data, so we're looking at different classes of pathogens, swine pathogens, but we're not have gone deeper yet into a specific type of pathogens. We're still looking at also what kind of viruses that are present in there. It's in the data, but we haven't analyzed the data yet to go into specific viruses.
He outlines the significance of these findings.
So these findings tells us that indeed the RWA practices contribute to the reduction in antimicrobial usage in the barns, but there are some areas wherein those practices can still be improved, or we can develop new management practices to make sure that we don't see this rise in pathogens, as well as to ensure that we continue to reduce the presence of antimicrobial resistance genes in these barns.
Predicala explains how this information will be applied.
This can be applied by the pork producers, especially those that are on RWA barns, but generally it can be applied by all producers, because the goal is to reduce the total antibiotic usage in farms, and that could be through practices like increased biosecurity, good handling practices or farming practices, and The goal is to avoid misuse and overuse in antibiotics, because previous studies have shown that if we do reduce the antibiotic usage, its impact on the occurrence of antimicrobial resistance is reversible. There's a study that's been shown that if overall reduction in antibiotic usage can lead to reduction in the occurrence of antimicrobial resistance genes.
And as for the take-home message?
The take-home message is that it's good news for producers that if we actually do the good practices and the measures in reducing the total usage of antibiotics, then we can actually also reduce the occurrence of antimicrobial resistance genes. So it's reversible, it's not permanent. So we just need to identify those measures that will help us reduce or further reduce or eliminate the use of antibiotics in our production systems.
Dr. Bernardo Predicala is a research scientist of engineering with the Prairie Swine Center. And that'll do it for GX on Agriculture for today. Be sure to tune in again on Monday at 12:15 for another edition of the program.